This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Luca Anceschi, and I will be the host of your podcast on NBN Central Asia Studies this afternoon. And it's great to have today with us Aga Bayramov, who has authored this very intriguing, very interesting book just out with Routledge, Constructive Competition in the Caspian Sea Region? Aga, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Luca, for inviting me.
The first question which I want to ask you, it's one which I tend to ask to all of the hosts, to all of the guests on our podcast, and very much relates to your perspective as an author. So how did you decide to engage with such a rich topic? And, you know, this is something which people like me have been thinking of for 30 years, but you have been able to working on this very rich topic and distilled in a very concise argument. So what were the reasons why you started to do this research?
Yes, well, the background of this research is going back to 2014, actually, when I started my master's degree in the University of Groningen, and 2015, my PhD, obviously, this is the PhD dissertation. During my master's degree, I also focused on the Caspian Sea and also South Caucasus, and was reading the literature. What I realized that time, South Caucasus and Central Asia, these two regions have been analyzed and explained separately or kind of jointly, but the Caspian Sea per se hasn't received enough attention. And that time I was wondering, everyone talks about even geopolitics or from a realist perspective or liberal perspective, constantly about land, the geography, but nothing about the sea. So that was a kind of curiosity. Oh, maybe I should look at it. And then that time when I was also reading, I realized that after every literature almost or article or the book chapter, I realized, wow, it's such a negative region. Because although I am coming from the region itself, but when you read it academically and when you look at it, wow, such a problematic place I am living in. And I am from such a dangerous maybe or constantly, a problematic place. I was like, oh, is there something happening that I can show beyond these problems? There are problems, but at least maybe these countries are working for it, or maybe it's not only this state, but maybe there are other actors. So that's how this research started, kind of curiosity, reading, and while reading, questioning where I am from, and is it actually like that, or can I find something different?
I mean, always on your perspective as an author, I mean, can you tell us a little bit more about the research that work that you did? I mean, there is a particularly detailed note in the introduction a bit about, you know, where you went, who you talked to, but can you give our listeners a little bit more of a perspective on how did you approach this topic as a researcher?
Of course. In briefly, my book is about the Caspian Sea per se. So I'm looking at here the what's going on in the sea and whether I can find the common projects, problems, and also kind of constructive cooperation among the Caspian Sea countries. But I also researched in this book whether there are other actors in addition to Caspian littoral states. So what kind of companies, NGOs, intergovernmental organizations, or the epistemic communities involved in the Caspian Sea projects or development. And from an empirical perspective, I looked at three case studies. The two of them are energy projects. One of them is a Baku-Tbilisi oil pipeline. Second one is Southern Gas Corridor, and the third one is Caspian Environmental Program. And the reason for these three, actually the commonality where to some extent Caspian Sea countries or their companies or their, institutions involved in this project, either in the end of the project or from the beginning of the project. And another thing is, these are the projects coming from the Caspian Sea per se, not somewhere else. So kind of interconnectivity I saw between these three projects, kind of a natural resource, because environment is also part of natural resources, or other way around, you should say. I saw it that way. And from theoretical perspective, I looked and used a totally different theory. I think it's not even familiar among the relevant scholars. It is a classical functionalist theory, which has been used in the European studies mainly, not a neo-functionalist one, but the original functionalist one, which argues or explains the development in the European Union, how European Union or the European countries after the Second World War started to work on technical cooperation, sideline the politics, and look for the common gain. So, but this theory was kind of present within the European studies. And then I said, well, I want to use something a little bit different. And that's how I ended up using the classical functionalism to show a little bit different perspective, because classical functionalism also provides tools to explain technical cooperation, role of different experts and different actors. So briefly, that's how I wrote this project about the Caspian Sea region.
And what about the actual research? How did you do to, what did you do to support this argument which you just described? Did you go on the field? Did you talk with people on the field? Did you engage with documents? What went behind the scenes while you were researching the book?
I think I did all of them. I mean, I would say, in the beginning, of course, I started with getting familiar with the literature itself, what is outside there. And then I looked at the documents, original documents that this literature, academic literature, refers to. And the main purpose of my research in looking at literature and the main documents to trace back from 1990s until 2018, what has been done with regard to the project development, and made a timeline in the book as well about each project. In terms of data collection, yes, primary resources, secondary resources, and plus field trip, intensive field trip online and in the region also. Mainly, I did the field trip in Azerbaijan because of the time restriction, financial resources back then. I wanted to go travel to Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and Iran as well, but I couldn't find funding for this. Unfortunately, my PhD graduate school didn't fund that. So I decided to do online interview, kind of online field trip for with those people. So I combined my travel to Azerbaijan to meet the people there. I met people from organizations, United Nations, British Petroleum. But I also met people from the Caspian Environmental Program, ministry from Iran, Turkmenistan, and Azerbaijan as well. I couldn't reach Russia, although I tried to contact with them, and Kazakhstan. Unfortunately, I couldn't reach and yeah, make interview with them. I also, to some extent, reach also the other experts and academics in the South Caucasus as well. So there were certain arguments that I wasn't sure, so I wanted to talk to them. There were experts from Armenia, Georgia, Azerbaijan, academic level also. I talked to them. So it is a kind of a combination of everything, I would say. And the most important for me in this research time was the field trip online, let's say, interviews and in-person interviews with the experts from the Caspian Environmental Program, because that's one of the understudied, I would say, case studies and issues in the literature. So I was so happy back then that experts from the UNDP, Caspian Environmental Program, and Minister of Environment and Energy were happy to talk to me. Also, environmental experts or the departments from the companies, for example, British Petroleum, they were also very cooperative, and thanks to them also answered my question.
So, yes, I mean, there is, it is an elite study, isn't it? Like, you studied what the elite told you about these particular issues. I mean, before we're moving on to the three case studies, I just want to raise the issue, you know, what you call the great game literature. And there is a whole part of the book which engages with that. So from what I understand, your argument, it is a pretty direct critique of this great game theory. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Why did you feel that you had to engage with that particular literature, saying that, you know, this is not helping us when it comes to the Caspian Sea?
Yeah, very, very good question. Also, very good point that I forgot about, and I forgot to mention that indeed the main critic of my book or the target was the great game, which great game, well, assumes and argues from a classical realist perspective is that there is always a conflict and rivalry between the regional, local, and external powers. And the state is the main actor and is the only actor. Rest of the actors are either kind of complementing or are the tools of the state. A cooperation is almost impossible to reach, and because there is always rivalry behind, and this rivalry creates a grouping among the local and regional states. More specifically, they see the region from a black and white perspective, I would say. So on the black spot, maybe Turkey, Azerbaijan, Georgia. On the white spot, Russia, Armenia, Iran, let's say. Or they divide it and bring updated version China to the field, like China, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan on the one hand. Russia is trying to involve and compete with China over Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan on the other hand. Here, Turkey and Iran competing kind of rivalry relations over the Caspian Sea. So here I could see the groupings. And then that was the main idea of this great game. So these countries are actually right. They are the enemies of each other, and constantly they try to, you know, dominate the region, either energy resources or environmental resources or legal agreements. The cooperation is impossible. It's such a depressive place that almost any time conflict can happen among them. And when I look at the original of this great game, and I realized that it was about more Great Britain and the Russian Empire back then. It was about Central Asia, especially dominating over trade routes going from Central Asia to India and also Afghanistan. That's the original, and it came from a Roman Kipling's book. But later on, scholars started to use this term even without explaining clearly what is this great game, because game can also be a little bit competitive way rather than rivalry way. And then after the Soviet Union, new great game emerged. from policy field to, let's say, academic area. For example, economics, the Economics Journal also published a lot, James Bond movie. So that was the main argument. So in this great game, Western powers mainly are described as positively as possible, and negative is always on Iran, Russia, China, because they are the bad guys here. Even the movie I mentioned in the book, James Bond, where an English and American cooperation over the pipeline project, while Russia and Russia, let's say, trying to block this. I mean, to some extent, I do agree with all with their arguments, but the question is it the full picture? After reading, I was like, okay, is it the full picture? And then the answer for me is no, it's not really the full picture. And maybe I can try to see different color there, because it's a bit, and when I try to trace overall also the great game argument, I realized one thing: whatever happens, either it is an infrastructure project, environmental project, legal project, or oil gas project, actors are same. Certain arguments are always repetitive in terms of, like, while European Union, United States trying to do this, China, Russia, Iran trying to block this. Like, it constantly happens. But then I realized one commonality as well in this great game. This great game argument appears in the beginning of the project and disappears in the end of the project. Like, when project is successfully completed or treaty is signed, there is no mentioning or go back in this literature. Then that I realized, okay, let's look at it maybe more critically and criticize these points, and let me do things that they are not doing. You know, like, let's look at what happens after project is completed. Is it still a rivalry relations, or does the project change the atmosphere in the region?
So you pretty much, you use this neo-functionalist key to unlock and this great game conundrum. And to that end, you focus your attention on three different examples of successful, if you want, neo-functionalist cooperation, which two had to do with energy project, the Southern Corridor and the BGP and the BTP. And you also have the Caspian Environmental Program. Quickly, why did you choose this set of empirical cases here? Why are they so telling for the story that you wanted to tell us?
Why I am telling this story? Do you mind to repeat that question?
No, I was asking why your selection was particularly on these three topics.
I used not neo-functionalism, but functionalism, because yes, here I made a clear distinction in that regard, because neo-functionalism, I tried to selectively use certain things, but mainly focused on the functionalist one. And why? Because, for example, Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline is among the projects that receive strong attention or a lot of attention from great game. So I wanted to a little bit challenge that and then show different perspective on the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline. That was the first reason, like, what can I use, particularly that this great game dominates, so I can kind of challenge their comfort zone. And I did this dividing the project in three phases. And I talk about mainly in the middle and the construction phase and the use of the pipeline. And the second reason I use the Baku-Tbilisi, let's say, pipeline, because this project mainly designed to transport Azerbaijani oil to Ceyhan Turkish terminal. However, later, after it's constructed and completed, other Caspian Sea states, Russia, Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan started also to benefit from this project. So this is one of the projects kind of I saw a commonality, because it's also an area indeed, and well argued by the great game scholar, that it's difficult to find something, but there is also something to some extent, a limited way. So that was the main reason. And Southern Gas Corridor is also same. I use it because it's also a place where great game moved and to dominate conversation there as well. And when I look at the actors from a functionalist perspective, okay, what are the actors? I realize that it's not maybe Iran and Russia are part of this project, but their companies are part of this project. So, okay, this project kind of shares some commonality among the Caspian Sea countries. And final project, environmental cooperation. The main reason is that environment is not received attention from the geopolitical literature because, well, it's not important. It doesn't bring any benefit. And to challenge this, I said, well, no, they are missing this because it is actually the main place where the real politics happens, where real discussion and disagreement happen in the environment. That's why I use the environmental project to show something new, something sidelined in the region and not receiving enough attention. Plus, it is the only project where five Caspian members are directly involved, and even their ministries as well involved in this project. So the commonality of the projects, that the projects were dominated from great game scholars, are the main reason that I focused on these three. And final, of course, a little bit my local biasness, maybe that I speak the language and I am coming from there and I feel more comfortable doing research on this project, considering the language and the accessibility to the region.
Fair enough. That's a very good point, the other one. So now I think that the most novel issue that you tackle in the book, I mean, beyond the great game critique, it's really this focus on the environmental project, which is something which is very new. I mean, I haven't really heard much about it. Can you tell us more about this particular area of cooperation? Why do you regard it as very successful or very relevant for your topic? And mostly, is there a future there for cooperation beyond the time frame you analyze in the environmental sector?
Yeah, thank you very much for especially highlighting this one as well, because among the three cases, I really enjoyed doing this case study. So the environmental project is called Caspian Environmental Program. Actually, this is the first common program among the Caspian Sea countries on a technical issue. As you know, in the 1990s, these countries were busy to divide the Caspian Sea, legal status, divide the nature of resources. Even there was a tension among Iran and Azerbaijan, or Russia and Azerbaijan, or even Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan on natural resources. So despite this negativity, these countries still came together to work on environmental issues. However, they couldn't manage because they wanted something internationally recognized, not dominated by one of the Caspian Sea countries. And these countries decided, because Iran was taking a leading role on environmental issues, but other Caspian Sea states said, you know what, let's invite international actors because it's kind of beyond our expertise and beyond our functions, and make sure that we follow the international standards. So they invited the World Bank, UNEP, UNDP, and Global Environmental Facility to help them, actually. And this environmental program, although idea here is to rewrite almost everything regarding the environmental regulation within these countries, also among these countries, to make sure that they have common environmental agenda, regulations, rules, but they have also common environmental agenda within their own ministries as well. So international actors, those actors finance the project, and they brought these countries together, their ministries, their governments together. And actually, everyone was talking about the legal status, disagreement about the legal status. But thanks to the Caspian Environmental Program, Caspian Littoral States signed the first legal agreement, Tehran Convention, in 2003. The first legal actually agreement was signed, or the document was signed in 2003 and ratified 2006 by all the Caspian Sea countries. And it was environmental document. And this document later on was also included in the legal status as well. And during my field trip, when I was talking to these people, like, why do you cooperate? What is the added value of this environment? They said, actually, this is the most geopolitical for us and most important thing, because environmental regulations can block Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, and Turkmenistan natural resource exploration. Therefore, we want international actors to be involved and make sure that any agreement, environmental agreement, is not blocking us. So in the end, these countries are not cooperating to protect the environment, but they are protecting, trying to protect their natural resource business under the environmental cooperation. And when I talk to the institutions and financial, let's say the providers, they said the main reason also for these countries to come together is financial allocation, because we are the one financing their ministry's project. So that's why they are happy to come together to get this finance as well. And one condition is for this finance is to work together. Make sure that in the end, you guys are doing joint project. In the end, we see a legal document. And when I talk to the local ministries and government, they really enjoyed. They said, look, of course, we represent our own government and state. However, we also see each other as a Caspian family, as a ministry level. Even if our officials can disagree with each other on certain issues, we still like to keep positive atmosphere here. So this as a government level, like not as a state level, but as a government level. So that was really interesting for me to observe and to also find out. And another point they mentioned is that under the environmental meetings, because we meet a lot, we also discuss other political issues, because we attend, of course, as an environmental expert to this meeting, but there are other people also present, for example, Minister of Foreign Affairs, someone from the legal department. So during this meeting, it creates kind of socialization among these elites or among these government workers. So we informally discuss what's going on in the legal status, what's going on in other areas. That was also very, I would say, interesting finding during the interview time, that these people view differently. And final point for me is when 2018 legal status was signed, these environmental requirements, part of it, were included in it. And again, geopolitical or the great game scholars argued that environmental agreements on purpose were included by Russia and Iran in this treaty to block the future projects. However, this is very, again, oversimplified argument they made, because they forgot that environmental kind of discussion, debate started already in 1998. So it's not something one time happened, but step by step establishing. And funny thing for me is that when environmental, let's say, regulations were, let's say, sponsored by the European Union or the United States, scholars argue and see this differently, positively, or they care about the environment. But even if this is sponsored or favored or, let's say, supported by Russia or Iran, geopolitical literature immediately see here a different perspective. I mean, that was also for me a purpose to show how environmental cooperation is perceived and what is actually really behind all of these agreements and treaties. Well, that was the culmination point. 2018 legal status was signed after more than 50, let's say, meetings between the ministries, and this agreement was part of it. And still, yes, when we look at the future, this project continues. Now the main idea is to look at the Caspian pollution and climate change perspective. However, I would say that the downside of this project is that, as I said, Caspian littoral states, they don't really care about the environment. The elite mainly care about the money they receive from financial institutions and the regulations that doesn't that don't prevent them exploration. So that was the finding right now. And this environmental project also received later strong grant, I think, from European Union. In Oslo, there is a Institute NUPI. There are some scholars, Elena Wilson and Kristen, are also doing the research on environment in the Caspian Sea. So I can really see that the topic kind of gained popularity later on. Now more and more people paying attention on this issue.
Well, I think that this is one of the most interesting conclusions that you draw in your book. I mean, I am one of those scholars who was very skeptical about the environmental dimension of all of this, but your book made me rethink, and you inject this kind of Caspian optimism, I would call it, Aga. Do you think, though, that this kind of cooperation that you so well articulate and explore in the book is going to continue on? I mean, my impression was always that the Caspian is a very static, not much happens in terms of a geopolitical or geoeconomic arena, whereas Eurasia land overland is a much more lively environment. So you got this kind of difference, you know, between what happens in the Caspian and what happens in Eurasia. I mean, whereas you draw a somewhat more positive picture there. Do you think that beyond the time frame that you examine, is there a future for Caspian cooperation in this area that you mentioned in the book or in some German policy areas?
Very good question. I think that's also the question after the PhD I was also wondering. And one of my observations is that, yes, to some extent it continues. However, here one thing we need to highlight, and as you said, Caspian Sea is part of course, the Eurasian, and it's not an isolated area. It's part of also this global development. In this regard, one of the future projects and beyond these three case studies, what's happening, and that's in my interest, is the development of the ports. Right now, Caspian capitals or the Caspian Sea countries, they try to develop their own ports. There are a lot of port projects going on right now in Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, to Iran and Russia to increase the transport, ferry transport, and also to increase the transportation among the Caspian Sea countries, but also to increase the transportation among China and Europe via Caspian Sea. So yes, one of the future projects and ongoing case studies right now is this port project, how Caspian Sea countries looking at the ports, and indeed these ports are very interconnected. If, for example, Azerbaijan develops its own port high-tech standards, and Kazakhstan or Turkmenistan doesn't do that, it doesn't make sense in the end, because you will have always a delay. You depend on kind of other country as well. If they function good in their own ports, it will also bring you benefit and more help in terms of time, in terms of logistics. Another thing related to this is the One Belt, One Road project, and Caspian Sea countries also trying to cooperate, maybe each other, but kind of economically compete with each other in the One Belt, One project as well. So that is also part of it, because that's the main project they are trying to join, it's the main project they are trying to advertise the importance of the Caspian Sea. Beyond this, I would say recently, actually today, Azerbaijani president traveled to Central Asia, and we can see that Azerbaijan also has increased its involvement in this region as well. Not only these countries, Kazakhstan or Turkmenistan, trying to involve in project in the South Caucasus, but other way around as well. So we see interesting development going on. And one of the maybe important aspect right now, maybe we can look at this Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, and when there was a war between Armenia and Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan tried to kind of sideline involvement in this conflict, because they are of course part of this Russian-led security organization. Like Kazakhstan refused even send troops on behalf of Armenia or send any military unit. So we can see that this Caspian family, they have their own agenda, kind of. Maybe, as you said, I am too optimistic in this regard. But here we also depend on global developments. If there is a competition and rivalry among the great powers, sometimes you feel that it influences the project, not per se their politics, but also influence the projects in the region as well. And currently, what's going on in Ukraine kind of increased the importance of the Caspian Sea, but also influenced the position of the countries, other two countries in the Caspian Sea, Russia and Iran. That's also one of the maybe interview again findings when I asked international organizations, why did you cut environmental funding? They said, look, the problem is not the Caspian Sea or the projects or the countries cooperating with each other, but the funding is dependent on the global development because Russia and Iran are under the sanctions, and the United States, European Union, they don't want us to finance their sanction list countries, even if it is the environmental project. So we have to also leave the certain projects and financing them. So this is kind of the picture right now. Caspian Sea has its own stuff, but it is also interconnected global development, not an isolated region, not an isolated area.
Well, Aga, thanks a lot. That was a very good point to conclude our conversation. So, and I guess that you also raise a few issues that may be relevant for your future research. And, you know, and we do look forward to reading what you're going to be writing in the future. So thanks again for being on the show. Today we discussed, together with author Aga Bayramov, his latest book, Constructive Competition in the Caspian Sea Region? I'll be Luka Czeski, and have a good afternoon, everyone. Cheers.
Thank you so much, Luka, for inviting me. It was really great to talk to you, and thank you so much also recognizing this project and my book as well.
It was our pleasure.